WMAQ and WMAQ-FM, NBC in Chicago. When you ride in a Fraser Manhattan, you ride in luxury. Yes, luxury, real luxury. The new 49 Fraser Manhattan at your dealers now.
And now, Robert Trout with the news, direct from the NBC newsroom in New York, presented by Pillsbury. This is pie time. High time for homemade pumpkin and cranberry pie. Tender, light, flaky crusted pie made with Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix, America's largest selling pie crust mix. And right now, Pillsbury is celebrating its leadership with a nationwide pie baking festival. You'll find your grocer has the fixins for your favorite pie filling and extra supplies of Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix. Get a package soon. It's so quick, so easy to make that man of yours a delicious pie of yours. And now, Bob Trout with the latest news.
Half an hour ago, President Harry Truman stepped out of his plane in Key West, Florida, and the southernmost city in the nation gave him a victor's welcome. Most of the top White House advisors and aides are along on the trip to work as well as rest in the next 2 weeks. They flew from Washington with one stop at New Bern, North Carolina, where Mr. Truman went to church in the 100-year-old red brick First Baptist Church of New Bern. The president left behind him in Washington a city full of people still talking about what happened in the election and what's going to happen when the Democratic 81st Congress comes to town in January. One of the first things that will happen is that President Truman will ask the Congress to repeal the Taft-Hartley law. Today's reports say that will be done before anything else except anti-inflation legislation. Mr. Truman wants Congress to take that up first. And before January is done, the president is going to ask Congress to expand Social Security. Reporters at the White House were also told that President Truman is going to send the 81st Congress at least 100 nominations that were brushed aside by the 80th Congress. Many of them are for jobs like postmaster and federal judge. The 80th Congress refused to act on them because they were sure the jobs would go to Republicans after the election. But there are some major appointments to be made, too. In Key West, Mr. Truman is going to work on the plans for his new cabinet. And back in Washington, they're saying that if General Marshall really does resign as Secretary of State, then the United States Ambassador in London, Lewis Douglas, is likely to become the new head of the State Department. While all this planning and talking is going on, Governor Dewey is crossing the country again, this time without the bands, the crowds, and the speeches. The Dewey family is flying to Arizona for a 2 weeks vacation. There's election news from Paris, where the French are holding a limited election and decided to put on a little upset of their own. France is choosing a new upper house of parliament, which has practically no power but some influence. The moderate parties of the center thought they'd win, but the party of General Charles de Gaulle ran far ahead of everybody else with at least 97 seats, more than twice as many as the second-place French socialists. The communists fell from 84 seats to 16 so far. The president of the United Nations Assembly in Paris, Australia's Dr. Herbert Evatt, established a precedent by appealing to the king and government of Greece to postpone the executions of 10 sailors sentenced to be put to death tomorrow, the first time the UN Assembly president has ever appealed to the government of a member nation. United Nations spokesmen in Paris are saying they don't know anything about those peace talks that are supposed to be taking place between representatives of the Jews and the Egyptians. But the rumors persist that the talks are really going on. In Moscow, Russia's war hero, Marshal Timoshenko, joined the Soviet chorus of harsh words against the United States and Britain. Timoshenko says the two English-speaking countries are fomenting a new war, and the supporters of peace, meaning Russia, are becoming convinced of the need for an active struggle against the warmongers, meaning the United States and Britain. And now for Pillsbury, here's Arthur Gary.
Thank you, Bob Trout. Please him with pumpkin pie, or cranberry, mince, or apple. But be sure it's your pie, the flaky kind you're sure to make with Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix. Light, tender, golden crusted. It's easy. Yes, and it's quick, too. You can fix your crust while the oven heats. Just add water to Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix. Remember, there are 9 full ounces, ample for a big two-crust pie, in every package of Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix. Get a package tomorrow. Listen again next Sunday at this time for Bob Trout with the News, brought to you by Pillsbury, greatest name in flour. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
WMAQ and WMAQ-FM, NBC in Chicago. In just 25 minutes, we'll bring you an interview with Illinois Governor-elect Adlai Stevenson and Senator-elect Paul Douglas. NBC commentator Clifton Utley will question the two new officials on the problems facing the state and the nation.
George Gallup, Gallup Hole, Princeton, New Jersey.
Yavapai County, Arizona invites you to start life again with splendid opportunities offered here for new business enterprises.
George Gallup, Gallup Hole, Princeton, New Jersey.
Desperately in need of money, who will not be governor of New York in 1950?
From yours truly, George Gallup, to the American people, USA. Your criticism is justified. We've taken vows when we were right, so we're ready to take cabbages and ripe tomatoes now. Very sincerely, George Gallup.
Living 1948, brought to you each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated stations, holds up its radio mirror today to reflect the color red. Red on the faces of the poll takers to see if we can answer the jackpot question of the 20th century in a drama document entitled, What Happens? Here is your narrator, Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. Greetings, pundit confounders, apple cart upsetters, political miracle workers. Greetings, you who prove that no one knows how beats your heart and pulse better than you yourself. As one writer puts it,
the moral would seem to be, never call anything in the bag until the groceries have been delivered.
And over such a simple, basic truth, the papers screamed headlines. And though many papers were not unconfounded themselves, joined the nation where the nation was truly united in castigating the poll takers. Some typical headlines.
The pollsters achieved during the recent campaign what probably is a world's record for being wrong. Seldom has a candidate been so counted out of the race before the people voted.
The radio voice, which used to announce that it was time to stump the experts, was not on the air with that program Tuesday night, but it might have been. The experts were indeed stumped. The public is entitled to know why.
And what about the public? How did they feel?
The polls ought to be embarrassed, but definitely.
Even all the way from Paris, Mrs. Roosevelt got in a dig.
This is a great tribute to the intelligence of the American voters who take their jobs seriously and do not follow public opinion polls. They are able to think for themselves.
And one Thomas Dewey, who was certainly entitled to some comment, was asked...
Mr. Dewey, now what do you think of political polls?
I don't want to comment on anyone else's misfortune.
As you well know, all the pollsters were mistaken. And of course, all promptly ate crow. Said one dismayed prophet...
I could not have been more wrong. The thing that bothers me most is that, at this moment, I don't know why I was wrong.
Indeed. Frankly, using the stars for her guide, an astrologist was one of the few professionals who turned up post-election day absolutely right.
It was simple. It was written in a star. The pole star.
But perhaps because his name is almost synonymous with public opinion polling... The brunt of the ridicule fell upon the shoulders, fortunately broad, of our good-natured guest and longtime friend of Living 1948, Dr. George Gallup. Do you mind if we review the situation, Dr. Gallup?
Not at all, Ben. I'm numb, with an N, if you please.
All right. Well, then, proceed, gentlemen.
Truman ran all the way, but Dewey only galloped.
I'd rather be right than gallop.
Gallop sure pulled the wool over our eyes.
But the humor truly flowered where it might best have been expected, at Democratic headquarters in New York's Biltmore Hotel. Here, as dawn broke with the news of victory, celebrants to the music of popping corks from champagne bottles blossomed forth with this parody of the Yale Whippin' Poop song.
We are poor little lambs who were led astray. Lamb, lamb, lamb. We're little black sheep who miss our
Yes, George Gallup in these post-election days has had to stand up like a man and take it. And part of the measure of how courageously he's doing this is attested by his presence here. To you, to the nation, asking...
What happened?
We give you, in the flesh, the man you're all looking for, the director of the American Institute of Public Opinion, George Gallup.
Thanks, Ben, for inviting me in off the end of that limb.
Well, now, Gallup, I'm sure you've heard what everybody's saying about you.
I hear them even in my sleep, Ben. Last night, for instance, I tossed for hours as a multitude of voices vented their wrath upon me.
That guy Gallup's a bunk. Somebody ought to take him out and string him off.
Gallup? Ha! It is the lab. Expert, they say. He turned out to be as expert as my Aunt Millie trying to change a flat tire.
Gallup! He's finished. He's done. He's washed up. He ought to drop still.
Go. Here, Dr. Gallup, have a couple of acids. That'll be a little better. Now, tell me, what have you got to say to these people?
First, of course, that the people are right about my being caught with my figures down. I was plain wrong.
Well, goodbye, Dr. Gallup. Good knowing you. And if you ever return to civilization, be sure to drop in and see us. And...
Wait a minute, Ben. Huh? I'm not going anywhere.
You mean you're not folding your tent in Princeton and stealing quietly away?
With Joe DiMaggio upon striking out in a crucial game with the bases full cry?
I'm not going to play anymore.
Of course not, and neither does the medical researcher looking for the cause of a disease. They go on and learn from their mistakes. I certainly intend to do the same thing, to go right on and learn from mine. The minute you think you have all the answers, that's when you're on dangerous ground. And don't forget, we've been wrong before.
Now, that's something I didn't know. When?
Well, if you'll delve far back enough into our records, you'll discover that we ourselves have put a black mark against our name in connection with...
California, the ham and eggs election in 1938. Our polling showed that the so-called ham and eggs proposition would be turned down by an overwhelming majority.
But?
Wrong. Dr. Townsend's ham and eggs lost, but by a much narrower margin than predicted.
We looked into that at once, sought to find out why we were so far off, discovered...
Apparently, Dr. Gallup...
Yes?
The people were reluctant to admit that they were for the proposal. The papers having made them out to be such crackpots.
Well, what can we do about it? We're bound to hit this problem again.
Well, sir, if we only had a secret ballot, that secret ballot would enable us to find out...
So, you devised a secret ballot?
Right, and we were never mistaken for that same reason again.
What's been your batting average up to now?
We have never maintained a 100% degree of accuracy and never claimed to. If you look into a paper I read at Yale last April, you'll discover...
In the short span of 12 years, modern polling techniques have been employed in forecasting a grand total of 403 elections in 12 different nations. The average error, 3.9 percentage points, has been virtually the same for all polling organizations all over the world. The high degree of accuracy is evidence of the reliability of sampling procedures.
If you read farther, you'll learn.
A poll might happen to pick a winner and still be 20 percentage points away from absolute accuracy. On the other hand, a poll could possibly err by only a fraction and still be on the wrong side.
Okay, but the fact remains, and it's probably the only fact that interests the American public at the present time, that in the forecasting of this last election, you were wrong.
I was indeed, and I'm not trying to alibi myself. President Truman won a splendid victory, which he has every right to be proud and for which I heartily congratulate him. I'm simply trying to establish that we have always pointed out that there is a margin of error. We have never claimed anything different.
I see.
We are still a new science with the same certainty that we know that we can be right most of the time. We know there are times when we'll be wrong. That's the law of probability, the scientific law upon which public opinion polling is based. We live by that law.
You live by that law, and the law caught up with you last Tuesday.
Right.
But specifically, as it concerns Tuesday's election, why were you wrong?
We suspect we fell down because of four important factors. These are the questions we are asking ourselves now.
First, the turnout. Which voters stayed home and which did not?
Two, the undecided vote. Did the undecided vote prove important?
Three, the Wallace factor. What happened there?
Four, local elections.
how much did local candidates help or hurt the national tickets?
I haven't yet the answers to all these questions. It may take weeks, months of careful research to get them as we intend to. But this is what I've been thinking about them. And if you're interested, I can perform at least an exploratory operation.
Okay, Dr. Gallup, here's your scalpel.
Let's probe first into
the turnout. Which voters stayed home and which did not?
I ask you to picture a town. Let's say a town of 100 persons of voting age.
All right, I'm picturing it.
We send our pollsters into that city. They ring doorbells.
Hello.
And ask, among other questions...
Hello, I'm from the Gallup poll. If the presidential election were being held today, for whom would you vote? Truman, Dewey, Wallace, or Thurman?
Let's say 50 out of 100 reply...
I'm for Dewey.
And the other 50 say...
I'm for Truman.
So you record these figures, and soon election day comes. Surprisingly, you discover that of the 50 who told our interviewers that they were going to vote for Truman, only 27 actually showed up to pull the lever for him. And of the 50 who said they were going to vote for Dewey, only 23 cast their ballots for him, leaving 50 who did not turn out to vote at all. So first off, your original percentage has been thrown off because of turnout.
So?
Well, you don't have that problem in the Netherlands and Australia where people have to vote or pay a fine. This sort of compulsory voting brings out over 95% of the people. Here in America, when you have such a close election as this, every stay-at-home makes our prediction more difficult.
I see. Well, now just exactly how did that affect your prediction in this election?
Just multiply that little town of 100 by the thousands of towns and cities throughout the country, and you can readily see just what might happen.
Well, now, just a minute. How come the Democrats got more of their people to the voting booths?
Well, something happened. Perhaps something we couldn't entirely take into account. Something like this.
That's $15.32, Mrs. Stevens.
$15? Just for a dozen eggs and a piece of meat and a few groceries? So they won't even feed us for 3 days?
Don't get mad at me, Mrs. Stevens. It's not my fault. Why don't you write your congressman?
Oh, I'm not going to write my congressman. I'm going to get rid of him. Like Truman said, that hideous Congress is just about the worst Congress that ever was.
What happened first, then, was that the Democrats had something to be mad about and apparently felt the best way to let off steam was to get out and vote for Truman. The Republicans had no burning issues. But most Democrats were sore at high prices and many at the Taft-Hartley Act. Then this happened.
Scene, outside of a voting place. A ward worker is checking off a list of party members who pledged themselves to vote.
Say, Annie, it's getting late, and Riley and Dunn and Pulaski and Greco haven't showed up to vote yet. Better give them a ring and see what cooks, huh?
Okay, give me some nickels.
The young lady crosses the street to a drugstore, enters the phone.
Riley?
Yeah?
How come you and your wife haven't come down to vote?
Well, heck, I was on the night shift last night. I'm pooped. Anyway, there's nobody here to stay with our kid.
Listen, we'll send a car up right away with a babysitter. And you check in on Dunn, will you, next door? I thought you guys were crazy to beat the Taft-Hartley law.
Last Tuesday, at least from reports I've heard, the only people really working to get out the vote were the Democrats. The labor unions especially. Working quietly behind the scenes had an effective mechanism to help them.
Yes, but now, didn't you come mighty close on total turnout? Seems to me on Living 1948, just before the election, you said that your figures indicated a 47 million total vote. Wasn't that
yes.
Right on the nose?
We had a good idea what the turnout would be, but we were wrong on how that turnout would split up. I had a suspicion that this was going to be a problem. Anticipating it, our interviewers, when we took the final ballot, were instructed to hand the person questioned a card matching the number on the interview form.
I'm from the Gallup poll. We'd like your assistance in an interesting experiment. Now, you can help us make our methods even more reliable by checking the following after voting is over. In the presidential election, November 2nd, mark one of these two statements.
I was unable to vote.
Or?
I voted, and voted for the following person.
When these cards come in, and they're coming in now, we hope to be able to discover who voted and who did not. And whether they voted for the man that they said they were going to vote for.
Well, so much then, Dr. Gallup, for how the turnout factor may have affected your prediction and the election result. I think you said the second factor was...
The undecided vote. Did the undecided vote prove important?
Yes. Please remember, as I tried to explain before, that Like everyone else, I'm just thinking out loud.
Of course.
I'm still awaiting the facts that our organization is in the process of digging up. But as far as I can see at this point, analyzing the undecided vote is probably the most important symptom we'll examine in this exploratory operation.
What went wrong there?
Well, in every election, you find a certain proportion of undecided voters. Ordinarily, you're faced with two alternatives.
Forget them. Analyze and report them. And what did you do, Dr. Gallup?
We found a large undecided vote. We found that they came to 15.5% of those who were registered and said they were going to vote. So we asked them,
which way are you leaning, toward Truman, Dewey, or Wallace?
The replies came back from about half of these undecided voters.
I'm leaning toward Dewey.
I'm leaning toward Truman.
But there were still 8.5% who said,
I just don't know. I haven't made up my mind.
So in any attempt to get further information, we asked this undecided voter,
for whom did you vote in the 44 election?
I voted Democratic.
3 out of 4 of the still undecided voted Democratic in 1944.
What significance did that have for this election?
Well, that's indicated the possibility that the majority of undecided voters in this election, if they voted at all, might have voted for Truman.
Did you use that assumption in working out your figures in this election?
Unfortunately, no. We assumed that this year, because of the apparent lack of interest in the election, that they probably would not vote at all.
I don't like either candidate. Why bother? It's just no use.
That's what I think, too. I was telling the gang last night.
Oh, I don't know who I'm going to vote for. I'm so confused. I've always known before, but I don't know. This time I'm so confused.
Same here. I just don't know either.
Uncertainty and its twin sister, apathy, we found statistically to be the prevailing mood of the country. Apathy about the campaign. Uncertainty about the future.
Uh-huh.
Because of this, we felt that undecided voters wouldn't vote at all. So therefore, we, and I believe this is true of all other pollsters, discarded the undecided vote entirely, feeling it would never appear at the polls and would have no bearing on the final result.
Now, had you taken the undecided voters into account instead of disregarding them, would it have made any difference in your final prediction, Dr. Gallup?
If we had followed our usual plan and had not ignored this group as being non-voters, we would have realized that most of them would have returned to their traditional voting pattern, in this case, heavily Democratic.
What difference would that have made in your figures?
Well, it would obviously have added to the Truman percentage at the expense of Mr. Dewey's.
Would you still have predicted Dewey to win?
Well, chances are that we would have at least seen a danger signal. The fact that we didn't is our own fault.
All right then, Dr. Gallup. Since the undecided vote does not alone account for the difference between your being right or wrong, what else are you investigating?
Well, this.
The Wallace factor. What happened there?
Yes, what did happen there, Doctor?
Ben, if I thought I'd be wrong about anything in this election, frankly, I thought I'd be wrong about the size of the Wallace vote.
Why?
Well, first, because of the enthusiasm of his admitted supporters. As you know, they were very intense about it all.
The warmongers in both Dickens' reactionary parties see their handwriting on the wall. Your handwriting! A vote for Wallace and Taylor! A vote for the Progressive Party!
On the other hand, and almost paradoxically, there were a few among Wallace's supporters who seemed to hesitate to admit how they stood. When our pollsters questioned them, they got replies like,
no, I'm not voting for Truman or Dewey or Thurman.
Well, have you decided on any other candidate?
Well, why don't you just put me down as an independent?
Thank you, madam.
Presently, we began to note a gradual decline in the size of the Wallace vote. It began in early spring when it was as high as 7.5% and fell gradually to 6%, then 5%, and so on. We hoped our figures would not underestimate the strength of the Wallace vote. We realized it might be the factor that spelled the difference in many states between Truman and Dewey.
What did the Wallace vote finally come to?
It finally amounted to about 2.5%. We were off 1.5 percentage points on that. The obvious assumption is that this Wallace vote, which was largely drawn from former Roosevelt voters, went back home, in short, to Mr. Truman.
So that's another place where the facts trip you. Point 3 in your exploratory operation?
Check.
Okay, anything else, Doctor?
Yes, this.
Local elections. How much did local candidates help or hurt the national tickets?
Now, what about that?
We've got to find out how many people felt that.
I don't care who gets to the White House. I'm going to vote for my man for senator.
I'd like to know how many people found it simpler, in such cases, to vote a straight Democratic ticket to get their man elected.
Okay, then, these are the answers you have for everyone, Dr. Gallup. The answers the whole nation's been waiting to hear?
Wait a minute, Ben. Let me put it this way. Those are factors which, at the present time, in my opinion, are indicated. It would be positively wrong to say that we now have the correct answers. We have investigations underway, and not until we have completed them, which will be some days hence, will we have evidence enough to draw firm conclusions.
Well, I'm sure everyone else who was wrong, newspapermen, radio commentators, political observers and others, are just as interested in getting at the answer.
I think so, too.
All right, then, Dr. Gallup. Now, get set for a tough question.
Do they come any tougher than I've been hearing since the expert's Black Tuesday?
Well, now, what would you say was the significance to the overall prestige of polls of the combined failure of all opinion researchers to call the shot correctly on this election?
I think that obviously to people who do not make a study of polls and still think of polls as...
Oh, they're just a stunt.
Yeah, I always figured they were phony.
To such people, unquestionably, polls have been given a setback. I feel sure that all thinking people, once they've understood the various problems and factors we must cope with, will not lose confidence.
Well, what should we expect from the public opinion polls?
On the polls we've taken on issues such as prohibition, the draft, the Marshall Plan, no one has ever seriously challenged our validity and accuracy. Elections, however, because they test action as well as sentiment, pose an unusually severe test because so many of the factors that control action are unpredictable.
Uh-huh.
People attribute a high degree of accuracy to us, and a higher degree than we ourselves claim. We have never held that we were 100% accurate. On issues like housing, high prices, the acknowledged margin of error makes little difference. On such matters, the question people want answered is,
how do most persons feel about houses or high prices one way or the other?
But on an election, particularly a close one, the present margin of error is frankly larger than we can afford. That's why reducing that margin of error is challenging us now. The challenge is to find out more about our own business. That's the job facing us at this time. Yes,
but meanwhile, you can't expect people not to wonder and to continue questioning the polls.
No, that is what they should. That's exactly what they should do, not accept conclusions blindly. People ought to be aware of the limitations in any field and take our results with the reservations we ourselves admit. I've often thought that some people felt that some oracle has been writing these figures. So, as a matter of fact, Ben, maybe all of this has turned out for the good.
Huh?
At least I feel that way.
How do you mean, Dr. Gallup?
Well, it keeps our feet on the ground, reveals us as human beings who can make human mistakes. And another gain that I count high is that it has once and for all destroyed this popular myth.
Why vote for that guy? He's going to lose anyway. The polls say so. Don't you want to vote for the winning candidate? Get on the bandwagon.
Last Tuesday provided a perfect test for the bandwagon theory. And it now should be dead forevermore.
Well, I certainly agree with you there.
And last of all, to me personally, it's meant a loss of 6 pounds since Election Day, something I've been trying to achieve for these last 10 years.
All right, then. You're not discouraged. You're not going to quit?
I should say not. I have said many times in the past that I thought that making election forecasts was the least important part of our work of measuring public opinion. If we had not been wrong in this election, as we were, I would have been happy to leave election predictions to others. But being wrong in our selection of the winner last Tuesday presents a challenge which I, as a research man, cannot ignore. And we will find the answers to this part of our work.
Then we can count on seeing the Gallup polls for a good long while to come, is that right?
Yes. I feel no different about it than anyone working in any other field when things don't work out.
But how do you suppose the people are going to feel?
Well, I have such complete faith in their wisdom, their judgment, and good common sense that I am perfectly willing to rest my case with the people.
Living 1948 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC Public Affairs staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Scripts are written by Lou Hazem. Your narrator was Ben Grauer. Music is conducted by Milton Caton. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.